that left the Norwegians without the Swedes to fight the Germans. He can tell you something of that. He's also been chairman for a number of years, I know, of the commission relating to the churches of the Reformed tradition, Presbyterians and so on in America, right? What's the name of that committee?
It's a Presbyterian Lutheran conversation.
That's
what it was. Well, I find it a little difficult to know where to start and to end on a topic of such broad interest as this. And yet I'm sure that every one of us is interested in the situation of the Lutheran Church in America today. We're all of us, I take it, a part of the Church, and we are aware of the divisions in the Church. But I find a rather widespread lack of understanding of why there are divisions and what these divisions mean. Sometimes there's a very great impatience on the part of some who'd like to bring everybody together into one great Lutheran church and be done with it. On the other hand, we recognize that there are forces that are slowing up the process, and we're not quite sure why. I thought this morning I would start in from the present rather than from the past and work back a little bit to try to find the roots of the situation in which we are today. January 1st, 1967, will mark the Missouri Synod has decided to come along. The ALC and the LCA voted on it earlier, and it will now become a reality. Just what it will mean, I think, depends somewhat on the past as well as on the future. We might therefore start out with 1967 and ask what are the divisions today in the church, and then see how these divisions came to be. I would put the date at the bottom here, and then go back as far as we can. The Lutheran Council of America. I think probably the easiest way to visualize the divisions that we have would be to put at the top of our chart the German Pietist group, then the Scandinavian, and then the confessional, and the anti-union. And the connection between the top and the bottom would lie in this, that we have here the LCA, and here the ALC, and here the Missouri Synod. I don't think you can understand any one of these three unless you see them in relationship to what has happened before 1967. There's a date that is within our own very clear memory, 1962, and 1961. For the ALC came into being 1961, the LCA 1962. Missouri's history goes straight back to 1847. There's really been no great change in the position of Missouri in all of these years, but it has very definitely affected what has happened on this side. Now, the LCA of 1962, as you may recall, is made up of the United Lutheran Church, the Augustana, a Danish group, and a Finnish group. In a sense, Augustana belongs rather in this middle group of Scandinavian, which the ALC includes the old ELC, the old ALC, and a Danish
room.
So that outside of the ALC, the American Lutheran Church here, it was a Scandinavian group. And it looked one while as if what would happen in the United States would be a joining together of this old group, which the United Lutheran Church represented, on the one hand, a Scandinavian group in the other, and a group that is organized around Missouri on the left. Sometimes it strikes me that you've got here the East, Middle West, and the Missouri, of course, would be also Middle West, but in a sense you could think of this as the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, and the Missouri River. For the great watershed of these rivers include a lot of American Lutheran history. The old ULC is the oldest of the Lutheran bodies in America. And I find still among our Scandinavian people a little suspicion of the liberalism of the United Lutheran Church. We of the Scandinavian group, standing in between, have sort of felt that the Eastern Lutherans are liberal and Missouri is too conservative. We have often in our Lutheran discussions heard the term bridge, and the Scandinavians thought that they might be a bridge between the conservative Missouri and the liberal United Lutheran Church. Personally, I think it's a misreading of Lutheran history. And if it is still the reason for keeping us apart, I think you would have very great difficulty in justifying it. Actually, what we must recognize is that in America, the Lutheran bodies have brought over characteristics from Europe. You can't understand American Lutheranism apart from European Lutheranism. And unless you understand the background from which these different parts of the Lutheran Church came, you cannot understand what has been happening in American Lutheranism. I take it that many of you are Norwegians, and you would be acquainted with the history of the Norwegian group, which goes back over 100 years now. You had, in 1917, the formation here of the ELC. And that is taken from old 1846, when the old Eielson Synod was organized, the first synod. It had taken 75 years or more to bring the Norwegians together. Why? Because the Norwegians represented different tendencies in Norway. The first synod was represented by the old Hauge movement, and I'm sure I don't have to say much about Hauge in this assembly. The great lay leader of Norwegian Lutheranism, one of whose disciples was this Elling Eielson, who came over here and became an itinerant preacher and thought he could build up a Lutheran church around lay work. But in 1853, you got the Synod, or the Synod, which was a very different body. The Synod represented the Church of Norway. And the Church of Norway was formal. It was very staid in many respects, very orthodox. And Hauge, while he stayed within the church, didn't like some of the formality of the services, of the preaching, of the teaching of the church. But the church that actually came to dominate the Norwegian immigrants in this country, to a very, very large extent, was this one that had been founded by the Preusses and the Stubes and Ottesons and others that you know the name of. Well, there was a very long period of strife between followers of Eielson and the Synod, and Eielson, who was not at all an organizer, couldn't keep his followers together. It led to the formation of the Hauge Synod. And so you had another group of Norwegians who were on the scene. To bring these together was very difficult. And the story of the Lutheran Church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church, as a couple of your men have published it in two volumes, Nelson and Fievold, is the story of how these various tendencies of Lutherans brought over from Europe found themselves in America. There was a while when the Augustan, or the Swedish part, was connected with the Norwegians. In 1860, the Augustana Synod came into being, and it included a Norwegian branch, but only for 10 years. And then in 1870, one of the Norwegian branches went over to the other Norwegians and formed in 1890 the United Conference, which was also a reflection of what had happened, because a part of these United people objected to the tendency of Norwegians to look toward Missouri. In the early days, the Norwegians sent their theological candidates to St. Louis to be trained. And there was a very great influence on the part of Walther, the leader of the Missouri Synod, on the Norwegians. There was an attempt to bring the Scandinavians together in Illinois, but it failed. That is, the Norwegians and the Swedes. The Augustana kept up its independence, but instead in 1890 looked over towards this side, and even not 1870, I should say. When it separated from the Norwegian group, the Augustana looked over towards a group that had been formed over here, namely the General Council. And Augustana has been drawn between its attachment to the Eastern Lutherans and its attachment to the Scandinavian Lutherans. And that characterizes its history all the way through. The Norwegian Augustana Synod, however, did join with other Norwegians and formed a group which existed until 1917, when it joined with the Hauge Synod, which had come down from the Eielson period, and with the old Synode. So that the Norwegians were the first group to bring together their various portions or tendencies into a common church ELC, though it didn't succeed entirely. You remember the Free Church refused to go into the Union and continued a little further down into our own time. Why did Augustana have an interest in the Eastern Synods? Well, there are a number of reasons. Let me go back a few minutes into the story of the Eastern Church, the old United Lutheran Church, which goes back to Muhlenberg's time, the German Pietist movement. And in here's the oldest synod in America, formed in 1748, the Pennsylvania Ministerium. And the Pennsylvania Ministerium represented the Germans who'd come over here after 1690, around 1700. They came by the thousands, hundreds of thousands. They flooded Pennsylvania, were in New York, went down to Virginia and the Carolinas, and moved westward over to Ohio. You had a great period of expansion of German immigration into the eastern states, and they started to form these eastern synods, the first of which was the Pennsylvania, then the New York, and Ohio Synod. This group came from a German background, which was pietistic to start with, for Muhlenberg was a follower of Halle and Spener, and tried to keep the Lutherans in this country as a unit. It was difficult to keep them from blending with the other immigrants of the East, but they succeeded and built up a strong Lutheran church. It's the oldest part of the Lutheran Church, and they had to fight with the American revivalist of the time. Methodism was very strong on the frontier, and the measures that they used were not the kind that Lutherans were accustomed to. The Lutherans were accustomed to indoctrination, to catechism, to confirmation, to an ordered life in the church. And this Muhlenberg had a great deal to do with establishing in America. But the people around the Lutherans, the Presbyterians less so, but Methodists more so, were rather free. And in some cases, like the disciples, had very little organization or very little order in their worship. So the Lutherans saw themselves separated from other Americans, but they were also influenced by them. And there was a period when some of these Eastern Lutherans thought that to be an American, you had to have this kind of a church. You should have extended revivals, you should have a mourning bench, you should have very emotional sermons, there should be camp meetings, and all of these things which the frontier knew from other denominations affected the Americans, or the Lutherans. So that there is a group of Lutherans who become rather Americanized in that sense. Not all of them. And here is where I think we make a mistake when we judge the whole Eastern Lutheranism, as we sometimes do. For there was a strain that kept the old traditions of the old establishment as it had been. The German language was still the dominant one, and it had a great deal to do with keeping the people together. You'll find in the constitution of some of these churches that it says that the German language shall always be preached in this church. No other language shall be used in preaching or in teaching. And they even founded schools which they thought would retain the language. To us today, it's amusing to read of how they thought they could build a little Germany here in the East, and they did to a certain extent. We still speak about the Pennsylvania Dutch, who are really Germans, and there are many of the traditions from the old land which stayed on. But as they moved towards the frontier and settled new colonies, they had to make a choice between keeping their old Lutheranism or being lost in the environment. I sometimes say that if the Scandinavian Lutherans in the Middle West are as Lutheran after 100 or 150 years as these people were after 100 years, we would be less apt to judge them. We still have lived, we in the Middle West have until recent times lived in colonies very similar to the early German colonies in Pennsylvania, and the language has kept us together. When the language falls, things begin to happen, and we ourselves have seen what has happened. But there was a reaction against this Americanization of the Lutherans of the East, and much of it came from the West, from Missouri. And here we meet what becomes a very influential factor in all American Lutheran history. This group of Germans who came over 1,000 of them in 1839, was it, came in protest to something that had happened in Germany. And the more I study the history of the Missouri Synod, the more it seems to me that that history has been characterized by that early period. They left Germany because Prussia, of which they were a part then, tried to enforce a union on all the Christians of the land. The emperor, or the king of Prussia, wanted the Reformed and the Lutherans to get together. He wanted one church, he wanted one organization, he wanted one liturgy. And in protest against that, the Missouri, what became to be known as Missouri, emigrated. They left their home, they left their churches. They were quite well-to-do. The story has been told in a book by one of their own men, Forster, Zion on the Mississippi. It's a fascinating story this emigration of a whole people, really, and they finally landed at St. Louis and built a colony. They were intensely German. The work was all in German, the preaching. They started a seminary. They began to educate their own clergy, and they had to decide what kind of a church they were. They'd cut the ties with Germany, and they didn't want to be considered a part of the German church, but they didn't want to be considered a sect either. Where did they belong in the Christian church? It's out of the arguments of those early days among the Missouri people that there came this strong leader, Walter, who became almost a patriarch of the people, in the sense that Muhlenberg had been in the East. And Walter decided that they could build a church on the New Testament theory, that the congregation of people elects its own pastor, and that they are a true part of the church if they hold to the Word of God. One of the things that seldom is mentioned in Missouri history, but which is very illuminating to me, on the way over, by the way, they were led out of Germany by a pastor by the name of Stefan, who was supposed to be very straight-laced moralist and turned out to be an immoral leader. They finally had to depose him in St. Louis, and that's how Walter came to be the leader. But on the way over, they discussed with Stefan the possibility of the Missourians applying to the Church of Sweden to have their pastors ordained by the bishops of Sweden, so that they would stand in the succession of the Lutheran Church and the historic succession. Nothing came of it, of course, and instead they have a doctrine of the ministry, which is that the congregation is the church. It elects its pastors, it educates its pastors, and the congregation, in a sense, is over the pastor. I know that Missouri would not consent to stating it exactly this way, but as over against the other Lutherans, the doctrine of the ministry gave the laity of the Church of Missouri and the congregations greater power. In the original Constitution, for instance, it stated that no decision of the Synod is binding unless the congregations themselves sanction it. Their organization was very strictly congregational. But in the development of their history, they came to be one of the most centralized of all of the Lutheran bodies. There's another Lutheran in Germany that plays a very large role in American Lutheran history that's almost forgotten. And I'm sorry that we know so little about him, because to me he's one of the most influential of, and in many respects one of the richest characters. Walter, everybody knows for his leadership. The other man is Lehe, L-O-E-H-E. Lehe was a pastor down in Neuendettelsau in Germany, and a remarkable figure. He was very interested in charitable work. He built up a deaconess institute. He made Neuendettelsau a center for missionary work. They have missionaries that went out especially to New Guinea. I visited Neuendettelsau some years ago, and it's one of the most delightful spots that I know in Europe. This deaconess home with the old people's home, children's homes, all in one place, around, gathered around the church. Lewis' idea was that the church should take care of its poor, should take care of the old people, should have a rich charitable life. At the same time, it should educate its pastors very well, and he had a very great interest in liturgy. And his disciples have had an influence in America in that respect, because Lehe became the founder of the old Iowa Synod. If any of you are members of the Iowa Synod, you would know the name of Lehe. Lehe had sent a lot of young men over to America to work among the new congregations here. We do not recognize the debt that we owe to the missionary societies of Europe who sent men over here in those early days. And Lea was one of the men who sent over many who became leaders in the early churches here. Over 200 men came over, sent by Lea and supported by him, to found congregations all over the Middle West. But Lea and Walther didn't agree. Lea wanted the minister to have more power in the church than Walther. Walther, of course, believed the ministers to have power. But Lea wanted the minister not to be thought of as a servant of the church created by the congregation, but as standing in the order of the ministry from the very earliest time. And in this respect, he was almost Episcopalian, and his interest in liturgy, of course, would probably brand him as a high churchman. He stands very close to the doctrine, say, of the Swedish State Church or the State Church of Norway or of Finland in regard to the ministry. And I mention this because this is one of the things, subtle as it is, that divides us Lutherans in America. It's very hard to put your hand on just how it works. But we're not quite clear all over our Lutheran church in America what is the relationship between pastor and congregation. And some synods were organized as a synod of congregations. Other synods were organized as congregations and pastor. And it makes a difference. Now, Lewis' idea was that the pastor is not responsible only to the congregation, but he's responsible to an order of teaching which goes back to Christ. The congregation cannot treat him simply as its servant, as the congregationalist churches in America would do, and which he felt even the Missouri Synod might be in the habit of doing by putting the congregation in full power. In a sense, it's an unresolved question, but I mention it here because it goes back to our very earliest history. And the result was that Lea and Walther broke. They disagreed, and Lea instead sent his men to Iowa, and they formed the Iowa Synod. Now, with the growth of the Missouri Synod, and Walther was a very conservative leader, Walther has probably influenced American Lutheranism more than any other one man. He came at a time when these Eastern Lutherans were battling to keep their Lutheranism. And Walther, with his insistence that the church has to be known by its adherence to its confessions, it has to know what it believes, it has to state its belief, it has to have a clear doctrine to preach and to teach. And that is the doctrine of the Augsburg Confession and the Book of Concord. Walther started a paper, Der Lutheraner, in 1844, which was read all over America. And it affected every part of the Lutheran Church in America. So that in the Eastern section here, where in 1855, you had a man by the name of Schmucker, S-C-H-M-U-C-K-E-R, who was president of the seminary at Gettysburg, and probably the most influential and well-known Lutheran in American history at the time. He was well-known among other denominations and a leader in what was then known as the Evangelical Alliance, which had meetings in Europe as well as here, one of the early attempts at getting the churches together. Schmucker proposed in 1855 that the Lutherans of America should give up the Augsburg Confession, or rather should revise it, should drop some of the doctrines that it had held, and should become an American church. Exactly the opposite of what Walther was teaching. So that these two men became the poles, in a way, around which the church moved. It's a long story, and the outcome of it was that the church rejected Schmucker. At least a very large part of the church did. And in 1867, those who were opposed to Schmucker's program founded the General Council. It's interesting to note that it's just 100 years. Now I have it up there, but it should be not here. It's 100 years between the General Council and the New Lutheran Council. And what's happening in those 100 years fills a number of books. The General Council became a conservative part of Eastern Lutheranism. The General Synod
which was the first organization of Lutherans in America, was established in 1820. And it's the General Synod that Schmucker belonged to. So you got a split in 1867, or even before, in the General Synod. And you have now two Eastern Synods, the General Synod and the General Council. The General Council was conservative. It founded its seminary at Philadelphia in opposition to the seminary at Gettysburg. Today we're trying to find an answer to the question what to do with two seminaries. And the reason we have two seminaries in Pennsylvania is that one was the old General Synod Seminary, the other was the General Council Seminary. The General Council became the conservative Eastern body, and Augustana joined that because of its interest in the doctrinal position. Augustana felt that Walther was too rigid, too orthodox, and too German for that matter, so that it felt much more at home with the General Council, and for 50 years was a member of the General Council. We had our foreign mission work together in India, and in many other respects felt ourselves a part of the General Council. But the General Synod continued. In 1862, the Civil War split most churches. You get a North Presbyterian and a South Presbyterian, Methodist Church North, the Methodist Church South. And it split the Lutheran Church. You got a Synod of the South in 1862, which was sort of between the General Synod and the General Council. Well, those three synods came together in 1917 and formed the United Lutheran Church, or 1918 rather. The United Lutheran Church then goes back to 1918, just the year after the ELC formed. So you begin to get groupings together again. Actually, what happened in the General Council and General Synod was that the General Council became predominant, the General Synod moved over to the position of the General Council, and there was not enough to keep them apart doctrinally, and in 1918 they did form one Lutheran church. Well, with the Eastern Lutherans in one group, Augustana did not go long in 1918. It became independent again. But the Eastern churches had united by that time. The ELC had united, and Finnish and Danish churches. The Finnish church was never split. It has a straight line that goes down from about 1890 into our own time. There were two Danish churches, so that from the first they did not agree, and you'll find what happened to them later. The most difficult thing to explain, and I can't expect to explain it very clearly here, is what happened over here. One of the synods of the East was the Ohio Synod. And the Ohio Synod was connected with Lyd. And it also had sympathies with Walther. So that in 1872, when the Synodical Conference was organized by Missouri, it included Ohio and part of the Norwegian church was also in the Synodical Conference. But the Ohio Synod didn't stay in more than a few years. In 1881, it withdrew and stayed by itself. It had a very bitter controversy with the Missouri Synod on the question of predestination. And it's of interest to us because the Norwegians got involved in it. And one of the groups of the Norwegian church didn't want to be allied with Missouri on account of its predestinarian controversy, but also in the Civil War because of its attitude toward slavery. So there was an anti-Missouri element in Norwegian church, which in 1890 joined the old Norwegian Augustana in the United Conference. And Missouri stood alone again after Ohio left it, except for some small groups.
The Synodical Conference has continued down to our own time, mainly with Missouri and with the Wisconsin Synod. The Joint Wisconsin Synod was made up of old synods from Michigan, Minnesota, and other states. And together with Missouri, it made up the Synodical Conference until a few years ago. And one of the interesting things happening in our own day is this relationship between Missouri and the Synod of Wisconsin. Both Missouri and Wisconsin kept to themselves. They didn't want to have much of anything to do with this group. They didn't have too much to do with that group exactly, except through one body which I'll come to. Still very, very German, very conservative. They wanted to have nothing to do with American churches. And here's where this anti-unionism comes in. Their heritage of being forced into a union in Germany has left a deep mark on them, even to our own time, so that they've been against all unionism. They call any work with any other church unionism. They wouldn't pray with other churches. They wouldn't have any kind of worship services with them. And both Missouri and Wisconsin held that position until rather recently. Now Missouri has changed. Missouri has begun to work with other Lutherans and even other Christians. And Missouri has been along with meetings of the National Lutheran Council, which I'll mention, and the Lutheran World Federation as observers. And it has worked with even non-Lutherans. The result is Wisconsin now accuses Missouri of unionism. The very same thing that was Missouri accused other Lutherans of, that they were too free in their relations with other American bodies. Wisconsin turns around and says, Missouri is not true, and we'll have nothing to do with you. So Wisconsin has left the Synodical Conference. Missouri has tried to get them back in, but they will not, as long as Missouri shows interest in other bodies. And Missouri's decision to join this Lutheran Council is, I think, the breaking point. Wisconsin will have nothing to do with it, and the fact that Missouri will join it shows that Missouri is unionistic. So that the most conservative and isolated body today among Lutherans in America is the Wisconsin Synod. Well, there is another group that emerges out of this. There was another group that came over from Germany against the unionist movement, led by Grabau, who formed the Buffalo Synod in 1845. And I mentioned that the Iowa Synod resulted from the disagreement between Louis and Walther. Well, the Buffalo Synod and the Iowa Synod and the Ohio Synod in 1930 joined in the ALC, that is the Old American Lutheran Church. And they represented altogether a German body then. An old body, the Ohio Synod goes way back to 1818. The Buffalo and Iowa Synods are younger. They have different backgrounds, but all of them German, and they formed this group in 1930. There were those who hoped that this American Lutheran Church, together with the Scandinavians, would form a middle group between the East and Missouri. And we had for a number of years the American Lutheran Conference after 1930. And it's out of that conference that there came the move to make the members of the conference one church. The Norwegians were members, the Danes, the Finns, the ALC, and Augustana. And Augustana had to face the proposal of joining the ALC as over against the East. And that was one of the difficult decisions that the Augustana Synod did make. It wanted this group along in the formation of a new Lutheran church.
But there were still those in this group who didn't like some of the things that the Eastern churches did. One of the things was their interest in the ecumenical movement, though I don't think that was altogether decisive. But the result was that in 1961, you had the formation of the ALC, which was the old ALC, the ELC, and one of the Danish groups, the UELC. And later, the Lutheran Free Church has joined that group. So you have this one great group of the ALC. Augustana, therefore, joined with the United Lutheran Church, with a Danish group, and with Suomi in 1962 to form the LCA. Now, if you ask me what the difference is between the ALC and the LCA, my answer is I don't know. There isn't much difference. It's a difference partly of history, partly of traditions, partly of language, but no more so than in some of the other bodies. And that answer, I think, is the more correct since we've been able to work together in other ways. In 1918, as a result of the conditions of the First World War, these groups formed the National Lutheran Council. And we worked together all these years, 40 years in the National Lutheran Council, the ALC bodies and the LCA. In 1923, the Lutheran World Convention was organized, followed in 1947 by the Lutheran World Federation. And they're all members of that. You remember the great convention held in Minneapolis, 1957. So I can't really say what reasons there are to keep the LCA and ALC apart, except this thing, which again is very hard to define. In the old ALC, there was the feeling that they might somehow win Missouri over. And there's a long history of conversations between the American Lutheran Church and Missouri before the merger of the ELC into the ALC. And it looked sometimes as if the ALC and Missouri might come to an agreement. They have all kinds of theses, and if you're interested in that kind of reading, we can keep you busy for several years, because the favorite method of Missouri in discussion was to draw up theses. You draw up the whole line of theses, and then you discuss them, and then you draw up some more theses, and then you try to agree on them, and then there'd be disagreement, you draw up some more theses. So there are chapters and chapters of these theses, which is very dry reading. I don't recommend it. But it is a part of the history of these churches. Well, it looked as if the American Lutheran Church, the old American, and Missouri were almost getting together. Then someone discovered the words didn't mean what they said and so forth, and they couldn't finally agree. Now we're back again discussing ALC and Missouri, in what way we can get alternate pulpit fellowship. For this is one of the strange things in American Lutheran history. Despite the fact that we're all Lutherans, all hold to the Book of Concord or the Augsburg Confessions, all use the Lutheran Catechism and teach practically the same things in our seminaries, we don't recognize each other. You can't go to communion in the Missouri Lutheran Church. Missouri Lutheran isn't supposed to go to communion in an ALC church. And there is some question whether ALC and LCA are in pulpit and altar fellowship. It hasn't been declared officially. It's taken for granted. And I think it's rather free communication between them. But certainly as far as Missouri is concerned, there is none. And one of the conditions for the establishment of this new Lutheran Council was that it does not thereby establish pulpit and altar fellowship. But it's hoped that those who are members of the council will get together. Missouri holds that this has to be a matter between the synods themselves. It cannot be a matter of the council. I was along in the early discussions of the theologians who
were asked to find out if there was any dogmatic difference that made the national, made this new council impossible. In other words, could we agree, ALC, LCA, and Missouri theologians, on the dogmatic foundation? And after a couple of years, we came to the conclusion that we couldn't find any differences. We tried everywhere, some did, and finally settled on the phrase from the Oxford Confession that there is satis est, there is sufficient unity. We don't agree that there's complete unity, but there's sufficient unity for us to work together, even if we don't worship together or have communion together. So this new council doesn't establish complete unity, but it does get us together in working. Paul Empey, who has been the secretary of the National Council and sat in on these discussions, drew up a list, I think, of 45 projects which Missouri has been working with these other churches on since 1918. All of which have been done without any doctrinal unity. Matter of representing the church to the government in military affairs, in Lutheran World Action, in helping the mission fields abroad, in publicity, in television, in radio. We've done these things together as Lutherans without admitting that we are Lutherans. So that one of the things we did accomplish was that we would treat each other as Lutherans and not have to prove to each other that we were Lutherans. And on that basis, we finally did agree that there was enough theological doctrine, unanimity, to make further projects possible. Missouri insisted on one thing in this new council, which is significant. In the new council, you can do things together or not do them together. You can decide what you want to cooperate in. One of the things, for instance, that Missouri is unwilling at this point to cooperate in is campus work. And we'll each of us have to carry on our own campus work still. But the one thing that we cannot choose not to do is to have theological discussions. So there will be a series of theological discussions go on in the new, under the auspices of the new council, hopefully with the result that it'll bring us together in pulpit and altar fellowship. Well, I'm sure there are questions on this, and I've left all kinds of gaps in this story, but when you see that all of these things have happened practically since 1917, which is 50 years, it is a remarkable story. 50 years ago, no one would have dreamt that the variety of Lutherans in this country could have come together. Though we should emphasize that the differences were never as great as we thought. The differences were in language, they were in tradition, they were in worship, they were not in doctrine, not in the central things. We had to wait until the languages fell, the walls fell away, until we got contact with each other, because many of these Lutherans lived to themselves alone. They were little colonies. Especially the Norwegians, you congregated in the middle part of the state, so that there's a homogeneity of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, which is not true of any of the others. I recall census figures which showed the differences between the synods, and that explains how you're grouped. The Augustana Church was the strongest church on the East Coast and one of the strongest on the West Coast, so we were much more distributed. The Danes, most of all, the Danes were all over and have probably had less unity than any other of the Scandinavian bodies. The Finns are small. They're divided into a couple of other groups, which I haven't mentioned, the Laestadians, for instance. But practically all of the differences that you find here, you'll find in Europe before they came over. And we had to grow out of that period and grow into a fellowship here which made us one. And we stand today, I think, on the threshold of being probably the most united Protestant church in America. I don't know of another Protestant church which has more unanimity in doctrine and in teaching and in worship. I mentioned last night that this feat of getting a common service book by 8 churches is something only short of a miracle. And there were times when it was a question if it could be done. But when all of these varieties of churches can come together and agree on the hymn that they're going to sing and the worship that they're going to conduct, there is a unity which has been there before. Now there's still another chapter on our relations with Lutherans in Europe. But I'll wait with that till Thursday when we speak about the larger picture of the World Council and the relationships of Lutherans to other denominations. Now, I'd be glad to answer in the few moments we have left any questions that you have, and especially I'd be happy if you would correct anything that I've said that isn't so in your mind.
The hymn book now, is it true that the Missouri Synod has refused to have a separate hymn book and has told its committee to cooperate so we will have a new hymn book?
Yes. I happen to have been on the committee that brought out the present hymnal, so I was asked to continue on a committee that met with Missouri a year or two ago, and at that time Missouri said that we're going to the next convention of the Missouri Church and recommend that we have our own hymnal. We don't think we can agree on a new hymnal. They went to the convention and the convention overruled them. The convention spontaneously decided they should try first of all to get a common hymnal, and this meeting that was held not long ago now has been organized and is taking steps to see if we can get a common hymnal. So actually the convention of the church went faster than the commission itself on worship was thought that they could go. We will have some problems, I realize, because one of the questions is how many of the hymns must be Lutheran in a Lutheran hymnal, which is a very... I thought sometimes, if there's time, it might be an interesting topic for discussion to discuss the making of the church book, because in this 15-year period, we had a lot of interesting things, and what we got out is only the result. If there is time sometime next week or two, we might spend an hour on the making of the hymn book.
Will the Wisconsin Synod then be the one that will stand alone?
There are a couple of small Norwegians that have gone with them, but I guess even broke with Miss Wisconsin. The Sliver Synod, we call them, because they're very small. There's a Lutheran Brethren also, which is a small group, and the Eielson group still continues.
It's very, it is now officially dead.
Is it officially dead?
No, officially dead. Well,
They were down. Though they thought they'd get along without pastors. They were a lay group.
Yes, 7 left some years ago, and on the last one died. I was in the newspaper conference.
That's the three congregations that were remaining.
Are there
three congregations remaining?
There were.
By
the last I heard, there was one in Clear Lake, Iowa.
Yeah, but well, that I know well because I'm from there, of course.
That's true.
But they don't have a pastor.
No.
Well, there's one near my hometown.
Yeah, Jackson.
And that
they're all together.
That was formerly.
We saw something in the paper about it.
Well, that's one less Lutheran group then.
All of this merger that took place.
No, I don't think the Lutheran Brethren would ever join.
Was it the laymen or was it the theologians that were instrumental in bringing it about, pressuring this thing of these mergers?
I find it very difficult to locate the. I think sometimes the preachers feel the laymen rushed it, and the laymen feel the preachers held it back. But I think that's too simplified an answer, and that it's a broad feeling. Many times the pastors are willing to go faster than the people are. You try to unite on the local level a couple of churches and see what happens. And it isn't the pastor's fault there.
Yeah, from the Union of 1917, we have many local congregations still refuse to unite, and where the pastors feel really sick about it.
Yeah.
Like rural and Iowa, for example, both pastors, Mr. Stewart, absolutely ridiculous, block away, one of them is usually legal. And there's no difference whatever, except just the fact they're blocked away. Right, by all the graveyard people come in and vote, the Christians in each congregation, must be said, because we have to distinguish a little bit of difference here, that the Christians within the congregation certainly are from merge, but every congregation is a mission field. And all those who you don't see except Easter and Christmas come and vote no when it comes to merge. This is one of the tragedies.
Yeah, there are places where the cemetery has kept congregations from merging.
What about this Association of Free Lutherans, right? And are they the ones that refuse to join?
Yes, that's a, it's not the part of this group. It's some of the dissidents who don't join. They have an association. I don't think it's more than an association. I guess that's our bill, isn't it?
It is. I'd like to ask a couple of questions. How much do you feel that the mass migration that's taken place in the last few years has brought Lutheran bodies together?
Somewhat, though I don't think it's an efficient cause. I mean, it's helped along, but I think these movements go back before the present mobility.
Your prayers this noon should include this area, because we're on culture today, and as you're quite aware from your culture, has had more to do with this than confession.
Would you write out any questions that you'd like to ask? We'll bring them up at the session on Thursday. It'll be in connection with this larger.
Our prayer fellowship will be in front of one.